Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On Keith Arum. For more information and news we talk about on the show, go to our website at www.geeksone.com.
Hey, everybody!
Yes!
Oh, my geeks.
Welcome to another Geeks On. What was the big silence and everybody looking at me?
Because we're supposed to start introducing ourselves.
All right. Hi, my name is Matt Ging. I'm an actor here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
My name is Donald Marshall. I am a writer and video game professional here in Hollywood, and I, too, am a geek.
My name is Pete Robinson. I'm a screenwriter here in Los Angeles, and I'm a geek.
And hi, my name is Aaron Hendricks. I'm a graphic designer and filmmaker here in Los Angeles, and I'm a geek. Welcome to Geeks On.
Yes.
With our very special guest today.
Keith Arum.
Hey, how's it going?
I am also a geek.
That was a grandiose answer.
He's like, hey, how you doing? Considering our surroundings, that's actually, you know, we are right now in Keith's amazing studio.
Well, Keith's former amazing studio and now the headquarters for
Geeks On. Yes, we've moved in. Yes. Don put down a cot this morning.
It's very comfy.
You know how we always talk about the Geeks On studio and how amazing it is? You know, and we talk about how beautiful it is and the big mixing board and everything.
The palm trees
and
outside
you know
the window.
We're always full of it. Well, this is actually what we talk about.
We're actually in that now.
Behind us is actually a recording board that is larger than three of me grafted together.
Yes.
It's
well,
very impressive.
Former you or you now?
Yes.
Mini. Okay.
All of me.
All right.
Well, let me give a quick intro to Keith and talk a little bit about him. So I first found out about Keith when my wife worked with him, you know, a couple of years ago. And she told me about this guy that she'd met who was really cool. He recorded the voiceover for a couple games that she was working on.
Is this prior to a conversation where she says, "We really need to talk, honey. I've met this guy."
Yeah.
He's got an enormously large board.
No, she just came back. You should see the knobs. She was just telling me about this guy who's really, you know, this wonderful, amazing guy. He's a great director. He had this amazing family. You know, he had his own studio in his house, and he was really cool. And that he had this really cool comic book that he was working on, graphic novels. And that I should check it out.
Your wife so knows you.
I'm at Comic Con, and remember last year we were talking about how Comic Con went, and I was looking around Comic Con. There's like last year it was really bad. There was nothing really good, nothing really interesting. And then, so I went over to Keith's booth, and I see this beautiful, like inch thick leather bound. Graphic novel with this amazing art in it that's selling it for $50.
Yeah,
it looks like some type of alien Bible almost when you just walk up to it.
Yes. What was the name of that product, Peter?
It's the Ascend Special Edition, right?
The Ascend Special Edition and for only $50?
And, you know, typically, you know, I mean, people are kind of cheap at Comic-Con. They're not going to be buying something that's like $50. This thing was selling like hotcakes. He's like throwing these books out trying to sell them to people. And it was really good. It was like one of the few things I actually bought. And it was my pick last year. So I kept saying, we're going to get this guy on the show. He's really cool. And, well, here he is.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Your booth actually had – there was like always people around it. And, you know, Peter dragged me over because I was kind of aimlessly walking around Comic-Con. I agree. Comic-Con last year was
– meh.
Was pretty meh. Exactly, and but when we came over to your booth, there was always a big crowd there, and I assume that Comic-Con did well for you guys.
It's been amazing. It's just been such a whole departure from all the stuff that I'm normally working on. I'm usually in the studio, you know, 24/7, and to get out and actually be in the middle of 220,000 people for 4 days. I mean, it's pretty demanding on every part of you just because you're around everyone who just wants to see what you're doing. In between our background in games and movies and television and now into the graphic novels, people were just wanting that. And this the project, the Ascend book, has done so well. And
how long did it take to develop the Ascend book? Because it looks like it's a piece of work. I mean, it's bound. It looks like it's bound like the Sandman special edition with that really nice leather cover and the sort of silvery outside. I mean, it looks great.
Yeah, it's
and the art is incredible.
It took about a year. Thank you. Yeah, it took about a year and a half to do the book and another 6 to 8 months to do the special edition. On top of that, we went back and reworked the book.
Wow.
This thing started off. This is our first original property that I did. This is actually surprisingly, based on a dream that I had. And I knew I wanted to move into creating original properties, and I was fortunate enough to have this as literally as a dream. And
that's went, I would say that would be unfortunate after.
Yeah.
you didn't think of maybe therapy first before a comic book?
Yeah, this actually, I was traveling with my wife, and I was away from my studios, away from email, away from phones and internet and cell phones, everything. And I was traveling with her. And went
bear hunting in Canada?
Yeah, I was actually at the Arctic Circle on a boat. Yeah, and not too far off.
That'll make you work.
Yeah, that was. All right. And I actually, I woke up at 4 a.m, pitch black in the middle of this boat, and couldn't see anything, but I just had this whole dream, and I just literally dreamed it as an entire, like watching a movie. And I woke her up, and because every year I'll have a big dream like this, not necessarily this theme, but I would have like a big movie dream where I would just sort of be watching something and like, wow, I could never ever come up with this, you know, while I'm awake. But I just dreamt the whole thing, and I normally I would just wake up and I'm like, oh, I gotta remember this thing, and I'll go back to bed and I'll remember it in the morning. And I wake up a few hours later and it's just gone.
Right.
Just, I'm like, it was something about rocks. I don't know. I just can't remember. So this one, I just woke up Valerie and I said, I'm sorry. I have to tell you, this was too powerful. I gotta have, and I just sat there for half an hour and I just told her the whole story, start to finish. Mm-hmm. And
did you feel yourself losing it around the edges? I always hate that.
No, and that's
it stayed absolutely
perfectly
pristine.
Vivid. And I had shots. I mean, a lot of the specific shots right out of this were all very, very vivid. And so I sat there for about half hour telling her the story. And at the end of it, I was like, I just kind of finished, and she was just silent. And I'm like, did you just fall back asleep? Because I mean, she just didn't respond at all. And after about a minute, she's like, you just dreamt that story? And I'm like, well, I didn't have that 4 or 5 hours ago when I went to bed.
Right.
And she's like, this one, you have to write this one down. But the fact that I had just told her the whole story just cemented it.
Hmm.
And then the problem was I couldn't get those images out of my head. Mm-hmm. And so I started meeting with artists like crazy, just like, I got to start boarding this. And I knew I wanted to write a screenplay for this. And I was already kind of leaning towards writing and moving into doing my own original IPs from all the games I've been doing. And I literally met with about 200 artists until it culminated at Comic-Con about 5-6 years ago. And I'd actually gone down to Comic-Con. I'd already been meeting with all these artists, and I knew that I wanted to have these storyboards fully visualized and realized, because if I was going to write it as a screenplay, you know, talking about angels and demons, harvesting souls, and fighting this war in purgatory and divorcing the earth, I mean, it's just, you're not going to be able to write a screenplay for that as a first-time writer and then have people really
What, $350 million?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah. Let me call Jerry Bruckheimer. We'll get right on that.
And so, and you are who?
You right, exactly.
What
and
video
you're...
game? So that was why I actually was specifically looking for it. And plus, I just knew that if I was going to turn into any kind of storyboards, I also wanted them just to have sort of the creative vision that I, sort of the quality level that I'm used to with the projects I work on. So when I ended up hooking up with Christopher Shy,
He's the one who did the art for it?
So, yeah, Christopher's the one
who did it. His art is incredible.
He's amazing, and we're doing 3 new books. We have with the new book, Dead Speed, that's coming out next month together, and we have 3 books in development right now. We have a couple slated beyond that, and we've just...
What else worked on before doing these?
Well, actually, this is probably, I think, his first graphic novel he'd actually done. He'd done a lot of covers. He'd done some stuff for Spider-Man and X-Men, and he'd done a lot of the White Wolf comic books, and he'd worked for a lot of different people, and actually even worked in the game industry as a conceptual artist.
He's got this marvelous sort of watercolor, like, dreamy quality to his art.
I looked at his artwork, and the first thing that came to my mind was White Wolf, so that is very interesting.
Yeah,
okay,
absolutely. Yeah. And there's a kind of interesting story I'll tell you about later that tied into the whole underworld story that
since this is a lot of this is kind of what you're moving into and some of your future stuff, let's back up and go back in time and talk about maybe how you've gotten to this point.
Because
we were staying at some great graphic novels and a lot of your but we're sitting in a sound studio here. I don't see the connection right off the bat. Tell us a little bit of the story of who you are as a sound artist and how we've gotten to this point of graphic novels and Comic-Con.
And why are there BioShock posters on your walls?
The story is kind of interesting. I wear a lot of hats, and I've just had a lot of experience in a lot of different areas. I started off around 14 years old playing professionally in bands. I was a musician primarily a keyboardist and vocalist. I was with this group, Fiction, back in Arizona. And as a kid, growing up in the 80s, it was sort of like, you know, especially doing electronic music, I had my parents had bought an old Apple computer, an Apple II, and I got a MIDI card for it, and a friend of mine had an old Moog synthesizer, and I had actually started up a band with this guy, and we started playing, we were doing covers and started writing original music.
Do you have any pictures?
Unfortunately, I do.
Oh.
Yes, I do.
We'll be posting those on our website.
Absolutely.
And but what was amazing was back then, all of a sudden, we became huge, and we were playing. We were on all the local television stations, all the radio stations, all over the newspaper. We were playing 2 to 3 shows a week. And at 14, 15 years old, making a few hundred bucks a night, I started. It was great. It was a great experience. And just being a musician and started touring and going around and making money. And mm-hmm. And it was really funny because I mean, when I was that young, I had to have my folks drive me to these concerts.
We'd load not exactly out the rock star arrival we all dreamed
no,
of.
No, not at all. That's not the Jonas Brothers or
Miley Cyrus.
Yeah, no.
Miley Cyrus, you weren't?
No, I was not.
I mean, you guys look alike.
But, we had the same hair, I think. Right. Same haircut. But so what was amazing was that I started generating a lot of income at a young age, and my parents knew better. They knew that equipment is just a huge addiction for any musician that gets into that kind of stuff, and they wouldn't actually buy anything for me. So I would just keep doing shows, and I would just take that money and
reinvest.
And I wasn't into, you know, drugs or anything. I mean, especially at, you know, being in high school, I was just sort of like, cool, I can buy another piece of equipment. And I started amassing this studio. So by the time I was 17, 18, I had this amazing recording studio, all this music gear. And but I wanted to go into movies. I was a writer. I was doing artwork. I was starting a lot of CG modeling and early just artwork. I was trained in traditional background in artwork and charcoals and oil paint and mm-hmm. a whole bunch of different things. So I kind of wanted to go into all these different fields, and I didn't really know what I really wanted to do, but I had this really successful band, and I figured, all right, well, we'll get a record deal, and that's something I had always wanted to do. So came out to L.A. to get my audio engineering degree at Cal State, and Cal State Dominguez Hills was the only accredited university in the country that actually had a bachelor's degree in audio engineering and electronic music synthesis, and no one at the school ever use their studios. We'd use it to get our, you know, our projects done. But they had this awesome studio.
Bizarre.
And so I would take all my recording, all my keyboard gear and all the songs I was writing, and I'd come in at night and I'd just start recording all my gear. So my freshman year at Cal State, when I moved out here, the first year after having this band out in Arizona and writing all this stuff, I came out and I got a record deal with Iris Records when I was 17 years old.
Huh?
And
jeez.
And I just moved out here and all of a sudden got a record deal, and my parents are like, all right, you're not dropping out of school. We're not, you know, they were helping
me. Were they
me.
At any point like, okay, this is too easy for this kid? What do we need to do? Put up some obstacles.
Well, they were like, oh, there's drugs in the industry. You know, you're, right. You know, it's such a, you know, corrupt industry. You don't want to be part of that kind of thing. So they wanted me to have something to fall back on, as every, you know, parent wants.
Every parent, yeah.
Yeah. And so they had a business program that I was also kind of there. But it was like, it was just the audio side of things was just so natural. And so I got this record deal and I had to turn it down. And the funny thing is, it's so hard for anyone just to get to that point, to get a record deal.
Hell yeah.
That when you say no, they think you're playing hard to get. And suddenly I had 60 record deals that started to unfold over the next couple of years. So by the time I was a senior, I had been turning down record deals from all over the country, and we had a bidding war of all these record labels wanting us to do this. And we became – so what had happened was when I came out, I had started the band Biohazard, and we were this industrial band. It was electronic music. I wanted to do something a little bit darker. And so we ended up having a huge following. We were selling out shows left and right, and we were playing since – this was 88 through 90. And so in 1991, I was graduating. I was like 6 months to go. And I told my folks, I said, look, I'm taking a record deal. I'm sorry. I'm going to graduate. It's going to be fine, but I'm going to do this. And so we had this bidding war going on between Sony, a couple of smaller European labels, and Capitol. And the guy at Capitol Records made us this amazing kind of deal where he said, look, this is way before 9/11, mind you. He says, we're going to do
this. This is also pre-Napster, too.
Yes.
Yes. This don't happen no mo.
No, absolutely. And he said, we're going to do this terrorist takeover of the Capitol building. And Hal Milgram, who was the president, they were going to actually abduct him, and they were going to do this broadcast. And this bizarre. It was this bizarre marketing plan, and they were going to do this whole thing. And they had this sub-label we were working on called World Domination. It was Dave Allen from Shriek Back and all these other great musicians.
Wait. You were Biohazard working for World Domination, trying to take over the Capitol?
Yes.
Okay.
That's pretty much
just,
that.
Just making sure.
Yeah. It's, nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Geeks On does not condone any of these
exactly. Needless to say, I was pretty hooked on their sort of pitch, and we turned down the other record deals. But the funny thing was that I was actually working on another band that was doing more commercial, like top 40 stuff. And I have the unfortunate ability to write really great top 40 music, and it makes me kind of sick to do that because I just – don't really subscribe to that. I mean, I can write it, and I had another band that I was working on that was doing all this great top 40 stuff.
We'll talk about Lady Gaga later.
Yes, and
any particular songs that you'd like to
forget
about?
No, and I will not admit it anywhere.
At least you're not really good at jingles.
Yeah.
Well, that explains why I saw the sheet music to Mbop on the wall on the outside.
Oh, yeah. You wrote Mbop.
Well, the funny thing was that so I had this alter ego. I had our full industrial band, right? We're getting this huge bidding war going. And then I'm writing this top 40 music on the side with this other band. And if the two audiences knew either existed, I would be just sort of disowned by both.
Right.
And so I'm actually at this meeting with the head guy at Sony. And we're playing them this new single. We have this sold-out concert. And this is going to be this huge event that we're going to be doing. Thousands of people, this one venue we're going to do. And that's going to be our deciding one. We're going to take one of these record deals. And at this meeting at Sony, he says, you have this other band that you're just doing these tracks for. I'm like, yeah. And mind you, I have like a shaved head. And so I've got all of my piercings in. I've got, you know, full military kind of garb. It's this industrial band. And he's like, yeah, that top 40 stuff. Can you play me that single that you guys just wrote? And I'm like, yeah. And so I played him that, and his eyes get all wide. And he goes, can you do this song at that concert next week? And I just looked at him for a second, and I walked out, and I called Capitol. And I said, okay, we're taking the deal. And that was it. I just walked out.
He did not get it.
No, that was it. And so, so we went through starting the album, actually right when we went into doing the album, recording our first album, which was that one, that poster on the wall. The second or third day of recording, the LA riots broke out. And we were in the studio in Burbank, and all the big recording studios in Burbank are actually all hidden. Mm-hmm. Like, they're actually disguised as old. The one we were in was like an old furniture building, and it has, you know, mirrored glass and, you know, taken down sign. And it just looks like nothing on the street. You just pass by, and you're like, there's nothing here. On the back, there's like cameras and barbed wire and everything else.
Okay.
And we were in Stephen Bray's studio, did a lot of the Madonna stuff, and a gorgeous, great studio. And while we're there, we're watching, you know, the television's on, and all of a sudden these fires are breaking out, you know, and the Rodney King stuff started going down, and it was like, oh, crap. And so we ended up shutting down the record, and it was going, you know, and it was just a crazy, crazy time. And album is finished. We're about to go out on tour. Band Frontline Assembly actually invited us to go out. We had done shows with Nine Inch Nails and Night Sereb and a whole bunch of other great industrial bands at the time of the early 90s. And we were contacted by this speed metal group out of New York, also called Biohazard, that was trying to get a record deal. And so we had this huge, giant following, but they had actually started in New York and doing their stuff. And they hired a manager and tried to trademark the name and approached Capitol and said, hey, we're Biohazard, and we're filing for a trademark, and we're going to put an injunction against your album that's coming out. And Capitol said, ooh, all right, guys, you have to change your name. And we had been around for almost 5 years, and all of a sudden it was like,
Capitol didn't want to fight this.
They wouldn't even fight. And we could. It turns out, I mean, it would have been just a slam dunk. It would have been easy. And we already had records out. We'd already been touring for years. And so our album was actually called Contaminant PCB. And so we ended up just coming up with a new band name. But, and that's where Contagion actually started. And so our first album, we actually released as Contagion, and it was all the songs we had been writing and all the other stuff we had put together from our first recordings. Went out on the road before the album was even out, and we're touring with Frontline Assembly, and all these people all over the country started getting like really mad at us, telling us that we're ripping off this band Biohazard, they were stealing all their songs, and we're like, no, guys, it is us. We just had to change our name. and no one knew. And wow. It was the hardest thing. And it was such an amazing lesson in branding and marketing and learning, because we spent all this time building a brand, Biohazard, and then turned it over to this other band who then walked into all of these other record deals. And not a bad band, but different style of music. And for years, there were these riots at all the Biohazard concerts, because all of our fans would come rushing to the shows and all their fans would be there. And everyone's like, well, this is not the same band. And they would be fighting over the band.
This is why people, by the way, if anybody doesn't know, pays good money for a brand, yeah. even though maybe a product might not. It happens in the video game industry all the time, where a company will buy another company that's got these brands, and some of those video games fail, but the brand that is covered by them is worth way more than the failed video games.
And for God's sakes, that's why people camp out on URLs, just, you know, so you can... Totally have the brand.
And, you know, at 20-something years old, it was an amazing lesson. And that was back... You know,
did it affect your album sales?
It killed. I mean, we still did great. I mean, this album still sold hundreds of thousands of records, but not compared to...
What it could have.
What it could have. Hmm. And what was amazing is that still, when people hear that I was... And people still know us as the original Biohazard, especially out here, because we were doing films. We were supposed to be on the original Crow soundtrack. We had all these movies we were already doing. Probably did about 5 movie soundtracks. And everyone knew us as Biohazard. So then when we became Contagion, it was like, oh, who's that? And it was like, it is us. And so it's such a hard thing to be able to say, you are this, and then suddenly you are that. And it's mm-hmm. the same people, the same everything about it. So that was just an amazing, amazing lesson. But what that did was that sort of pushed my career in kind of in a different direction. So now, starting as a professional musician and touring and doing all sorts of different types of things, learning about how to position yourself, how to market yourself. And I'm really not attracted to the marketing side of things, but I understand it. I mean, when you're making flyers and you're trying to get thousands of people to go to your shows, you learn about how to get your name out there.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I also hated that side of me. I didn't like having to sell myself. I didn't like having to go out there and say, hey guys, look at me, look, I'm this great big rock star.
Right.
And I just really shied away from that. So I ended up moving into more of a studio capacity and started scoring movies. As soon as I came back from touring, all these film directors started approaching me to score their movies, because mm-hmm. industrial music, regardless of the vocals or how aggressive it is, just musically, it's a really strong style for doing mm-hmm. films.
Mm-hmm.
And started just getting involved in scoring films. But at the same time, video games were starting to take off and mm-hmm. explode. And the whole time we were on the road, we were playing video games in the back of the tour bus. We were just touring around, and the driver's riding around, and we're in the back and just playing Street Fighter and all these early video games. And but back then, the technology really wasn't there for doing high-end audio.
It must have been interesting for you to hear the video game industry sound catch up to probably what you were used to, because that happened
fast.
And now it's actually
I'm trying to think back to the early 90s. Movies. That was like the tail end of MIDI, wasn't it?
Yeah,
well, it's still definitely MIDI. And that was the problem, was that they were, you know, it was the early Super Nintendo and mm-hmm. the Genesis and all those early systems, and they were using MIDI systems, and they had like, they could do like...
But it was amazing what they could do with that. I mean, I still remember like Street Fighter 2, like the Spain level, like the flamenco bit, was like one of the best pieces of music ever in a video game at the time. I would just like fight to get up to the Spain level and then not care about what
came after.
But
doesn't it? So, okay, here's an interesting question. Does it frustrate you now to hear? I hear every time I turn on the pop music, somebody's using a MIDI track, somebody's using a video game track from Mario Brothers as the bass structure for their music, and it drives me nuts. It's like, not only are they not writing anything individual or interesting, they're specifically going to something which was poor quality in the first place.
I don't know.
Because it breeds nostalgia.
Yeah, but I know, like, Freeze Pop, which is a band I like, they go back and use some old video game sounds, and they have some, like, cool stuff. I mean, it doesn't...
Yeah.
You use a violin.
Yeah.
Well, how old school can you freaking get?
No.
Well, I think that, you know, you hear old stuff where you had, you know, old sampled albums and other things where there's real scratchy kind of things. So I think that for the next generation of people saying, well, they grew up with video games and that music style, so we're going to bring that in. And I understand why they do that. I'm not a big subscriber of doing that kind of stuff, because obviously I'm writing stuff. And
sure. You know, I don't like canned. Or restructured mm-hmm. something that has already existed. I mean, that's the thing of the last...
Yeah, but that's a matter of taste. Right. That's all it is.
The last 5 years, it's just, you know, everything is just redux.
Yeah,
redux,
and
redux,
I can
redux,
say
redux.
The same thing, but then when I hear something that has this little bit of like an Ella Fitzgerald sample somewhere in the background, I start losing my mind. You know, what can I do? You know?
But what was interesting is the whole time when we were playing games like Street Fighter, like you could hear that the... the technology wasn't there, even though on the digital audio recording side of things it was. I mean, albums and obviously had everything been done that way for lots of years. But what ended up happening with the game side was you could just hear small samples and little things starting to creep their way in. And Sega Genesis was actually pretty neat because it was an FM music synthesizer. So it actually had a synthesizer built into it. It wasn't just, you know, MIDI and little canned sounds, but it actually had a synthesizer. Plus, it had a little digital audio track. And you had, I think, maybe like a second or so that you could load in of sounds. So you could actually take little tiny sampled sounds and load them in. So instead of just playing a synthesizer and MIDI, you could actually take these little triggered sounds.
I remember that was the point when it stopped sounding tinny.
Yeah. And my feeling is that with technology, and this is the way I approach all technology, and not just for music or audio recording, but any technology, is so many people try to use technology for what it can't do as opposed to taking advantage of what it can do really well.
Exactly.
And so in video games, and as sound as an example, is that people would take a MIDI card or kind of an old school sort of sound card that really can't do full fidelity, and they try to do a full orchestral score, or they'll try to do a full band. And you can tell because it sounds cheesy. It sounds like these little tiny samples playing it. Whereas if it was designed as a synthesizer and it has the ability to do something really well, pick a style of music that can show off what that technology can do and write for the technology that it's utilizing, as opposed to trying to push it and trying to say, oh, I'm going to do this really cool guitar solo that's obviously not a guitar. Right. It's like, just get a sample of a guitar and use that if you're going to digitize something. Yeah. But don't try to make this little MIDI thing play because it just sounds cheesy. Right. And so my feeling is that do what it can do best as opposed to pushing it to something that it can't do. Hmm. I respect the fact of trying to push technology and try to do something beyond what the limitations are. But don't pass it off as that is sort of what's good quality now. And I think that's sort of the problem that's plagued a lot of video games and a lot of other industries, is that they're constantly ahead of the curve. We're not just cutting edge, we're bleeding edge, right? Mm-hmm. And we're developing stuff that's going to be 24 months ahead, and we have to know what's going to be cool in 2 years from now. So we're working with technology now that no one's embracing. Mm-hmm. And so by the time it comes out, we're like, oh, so 2 years ago. But everyone else in the world is like, oh, this is brand new. Yeah. And so the problem is that they're pushing so far ahead with so many of these technologies that it can't do it, that by the time it does catch up, then it just really isn't really taking advantage of what it can do now. And that's why you see a lot of next-gen consoles, once they've been out for a while, you see better and better games coming out because they're more familiar with the technology. Sure. They can do things.
So are you still writing soundtracks and stuff like that for – is that primarily what you're doing in here, or are you just – or are you also mixing?
Yeah, well, so – sorry, it's been kind of long-winded kind of explanation of kind of where I'm going. But what I did is that taught me as not just as a musician, but I ended up learning to record as an engineer, and that was what my degree was in. So I started becoming not just a composer but an engineer, getting into video games, learned how to program and do a lot of stuff for video game development. But that ended up turning to so many other things because a lot of the music that I did had voices and sound effects in it. So I was doing a lot of sound design in the music, and all the early industrial music especially was you're sampling giant, you know, you're smashing on, you know, big steel drums, and you're smashing glass, and you're using those as instruments as early, you know, sampled sounds, and those become the percussive elements for the music. That's where industrial music really got a lot of its sort of style. So I was really used to recording all this stuff, taking out my microphones, building a studio, recording all that stuff, and then working into the music. But that became sound design and mixing and dialogue recording and vocal recording, obviously, and all those different elements. So all those things started to become sort of tools that I was using so I could then start designing sound effects. So when I started working on video games, I started off as a composer, and I think the first game I did was I did the original BattleTech on this.
Whoa!
Yeah, that
really?
Was
you just broke Matt's little mind.
Oh, cool! It was my favorite game.
PC?
On the Genesis.
Okay.
My favorite game.
And actually, I won all these awards, and it was such a great experience because when they brought me in, they had a composer that was working on the project for 9 months, and they had asked him, like, where's all the music? He'd been working here for 9 months, and the guy just up and quit. And it turns out he'd only worked on, like, one or two songs over this nine-month period. It was a very difficult technology to work with at the time, especially if you didn't have a background in doing this kind of stuff. So people who were learning it were sort of – the tools were just terrible back then. Hmm. They're still kind of trying on a lot of the systems, but back then it was really archaic. So I was actually taking my studio gear and interfacing it into this little Sega Genesis, and I was able to program using my MIDI sequencers, test out, build all the sounds, and load it in. And that's how that took off. And as soon as I did that, everyone started approaching me to do stuff.
Since video games are constantly changing and they're constantly updating, how do you keep your music relevant? I mean, one of the things is, like, I look at Star Wars, Superman, stuff like that. There's something about John Williams' style of music that makes that, you know, I can still watch those films and I'm not knocked out of the film by his music.
Totally.
However, if you watch something like Lady Hawk, like, immediately
the soundtrack.
God bless Tangerine Dream for what they tried to do, but it doesn't really carry out of the 80s.
It just doesn't carry. So do you do anything specific to say, okay, I'm trying to encourage replay value to this video game, or I'm trying to do something timeless, or are you just trying to embrace the quality of what the video game actually is?
Well, I think it depends on the project and how it dictates it. I mean, to me, a really good score for a film or for a video game is something that you don't notice, actually. And that's the problem. I mean, something like John Williams is the opposite. I mean, obviously, John Williams has amazing themes that are very,
right.
You know, you get that theme stuck in your head and you can remember it. You can hum it and you can walk away and hum Star Wars or Indiana Jones or any of the other different.
Although I can never hum Superman and then Star Wars in the same way. It takes me about half an hour to get both of them together.
But a lot of composers really can't do that. I mean, or haven't done that. The problem with video games is if you do have a theme that
it will haunt you forever.
It will, because it just loops and loops and loops and loops and loops, and you're like, okay, first couple times you're like, all right, you know, I heard it the first time, it was cool. By the time you hear that, and same with sound effects. If you hear the best sound effect or the best riff, can get so stale after the second or third time. By the time you hear that 100 or 1,000 times, you just want to smash the machine into the wall. So to me,
Tetris.
Yeah, you just want something that helps sort of the ambience and the environment, and you want to push sort of the emotional context of it without it standing out and saying, look at me, look at me. And now if it's a theme or it's a title track or it's a menu screen or it's something for the credits, then yeah, go crazy and it can be totally cool. But really, my approach is sort of looking at the thing. We just did one of the big scores I was really proud of this past year was Golden Axe, the new one that just came out.
Okay.
And what we did is I was looking at films like Apocalypto, which I thought had a great soundtrack, and looked at some early Peter Gabriel soundtracks for, like,
Birdie
and stuff like that. Just really great rhythmic stuff that used, you know, world instruments.
Using the kora and with the stuff with Peter Gabriel stuff is awesome.
Exactly. And then taking orchestral elements. I mean, orchestral instruments are pretty universal and pretty timeless. I mean, and that's the thing is, I think if you look at soundtracks from the 80s that were using instruments of that time, right, and early synthesizers or other things that were
Vangelis.
Exactly. I mean, still great.
I love Vangelis. What are you talking about?
He's freaking awesome.
No, okay. You diss Vangelis, I cut you. I'm sorry.
But if you look at 1492 versus something like
Blade Runner.
But
oh, I mean something.
Just in terms of instrumentation-wise, like if you listen to 1492, you wouldn't be able to tell what year that score was done.
Right.
Whereas if you do listen to Blade Runner, you're saying, okay, that is 80s. It's still a great soundtrack,
yeah.
But it's very much, okay, that was the technology of the time, and you can hear that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so my feeling is that if you're going to try to create something that's timeless, then you need to use instrumentation that's timeless. You can create any kind of thematic content separately from that, but the idea is how you bring that palette together is what's going to dictate when that is. And if you say, oh yeah, that was so 2003, you know, versus something that you're like, you have no idea when that score was done. And that's sort of my approach to it, is that I don't want to be obtrusive to the player or to the viewer unless it's something that's there. And actually, my love of sound design worked its way into a lot of music. So there's we'll talk about it later, but a motion picture I'm directing later this year called Frost Road, most of the score is actually going to be sound design. There's not a lot of music in the movie at all.
Wow.
And only key elements, because I actually like the idea. If you look at a movie like Aliens, for example, the end scene with the loader fighting the queen alien, there's no music at all.
Yeah.
Not until they open the airlock. And that's when the music kicks in. But that whole fight with Sigourney Weaver and the Queen Alien, there's no music. But
really?
You don't remember that. It strips things down.
Like, there's an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer where the entire theme of the entire episode was there is no music and nobody can speak.
Oh, no. Wait, Hush?
Yeah, Hush.
Hush
nobody
is a
can
brilliant
speak,
episode.
And there is no music. And it makes some of the stuff that goes on. I mean, it's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's not, you know, heavy literature. But it makes it difficult to watch.
That actually was
no cushion.
That was the first episode I ever watched, and it was the episode that actually convinced me that Buffy was a good show, because the whole episode consists in silence,
right?
And the villains are silent, and they rob everybody of sound, and you can't scream.
And the problem is that music is a crutch, and I mean this in I'm a musician, right? So I can sort of put my sort of taste on this. But
it fixes things.
It tells you how you should feel.
Yeah.
Right? It says, okay, this is scary music. You should be scared. And this is dynamic. This should be huge.
But as a filmmaker, you do use it to fix things. You're like, you know what? This is not working. Maybe let's drop in some music, temp music, and see if it's working.
It's the same for video games. I'll be honest. I've produced a couple games where I'm like, okay, we need to bring in a really energetic loop here because this ain't...
This is something you can especially see when they re-edit trailers to things, and they take a movie that's like a horror movie and turn it into a comedy.
Right.
Shine.
But that's exactly right.
Yeah.
But then at the flip side, look at something like The Matrix. Music, absolutely. I mean, that movie is great with or without music. But
we're talking the first one, not the first one.
Right. Yeah. But. If you look at how they approach music in a film like that, or a film like Run Lola Run, right? Fantastic way. I mean, that movie is edited to that, and I mean, Tom's just an amazing director and a great guy, and he writes with a couple other composers, and even I just watched the International, and just even the use of music in that is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But music really is a crutch in the sense that it does tell you what to expect leading up to something. So if you're doing a horror movie, which is what Frost Road is, or a thriller, and you don't want someone to know until it happens, then to take away that crutch is so unnerving. To me, that's to not give the viewer the benefit of, well, this is, you're supposed to be scared.
You know, the whole high violins that they always have doing tremolo.
It is interesting, though. I mean, it changes the art form. You know, a lot of people don't go to scary movies for a genuine scare. They go to the scary movie for the anticipation of a scare, which is a completely different film.
Right.
You know?
And look at
my wife can't watch horror movies because the music just spins her so far out. It's very strange.
You should ever watch The Thing, John Carpenter.
Yeah.
That's got a great...
Yeah, that's true.
And it's that, like one note.
Actually, that movie was one of the first movies that got me into wanting to score films.
I mean,
a very simple soundtrack, but it was early 80s.
Yeah.
Very basic, but very... I mean, just the tone of that was great. Now, don't get me wrong. I love music in films. I'm not against it at all. I just feel that if it's overused or abused, it shouldn't... that's when I take issue with it. And most of the time, I feel that the score should compel you to feel the emotion of that scene... Based on, and obviously, if you have better visuals, then the music's going to go better, and the music can definitely help, and it always does. And I'm always brought in as a composer. The first horror film I ever did, the director said, "This isn't working. Can you just make this scary?" And I was like, "Okay." Yeah, and I was like, "But so that's why
this type of directions."
and that always had frustrated me. And so for me as a director now, I want to use it in the right context. And when I want to have that thematic content, I want to be able to use that. When I do need that crutch, it's a tool. Mm-hmm. And it should be viewed as such. But at the same time, great music is still great music. Right. And I think that it needs to be utilized in the right way.
Now, when Bear McCreary was working on his most recent video game, he had actually wanted to create a John Williams quality. He wanted to have these thematic elements. Now, the video game that he's working on has a character that can fly or walk on the ground. And he had wanted to create things that felt, you know, soaring every time the kid would fly, and every time he'd walk, he wanted something more grounded. The problem was that the player has the ability to either fly or land at any point in time, and so what happened with the music was that it would... It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
So eventually he had to create this score that felt... that was more defined to the level. And he would go have them walk through the whole level and design the music to it. But it was very hard for him to do that. What was the hardest video game or movie that you've had to score?
That's the challenge, is that a lot of times you're going to have theme content based by the level. A lot of times games are themed and they want to have, say, okay, well, this is our Jamaican level and this is going to be our Arctic level, right? Yeah. And so the problem is then they're like, okay, well, we want a theme for the overall arc of the game. Plus we want a theme for each environment that you're in. Plus this character has a theme. Yeah. And so every game sort of has that, and that's always the challenge. And then dynamic mixing.
Well, I know about Jamaican music, but is there Arctic music?
Well, that's the problem. You're like, what? So Antarctic or
look up
Arctic?
Antarctica by Vangelis for more information, man.
So I think that that's always a challenge. And honestly, there's every game has its own challenges. But going back to like this most recent one we just did with Golden Axe, we wanted to theme them based on those different areas, and we did the first half of the score we did is dynamic mixes. So what we did is they said, oh, we have like 16, 18 stems that we can play at all one time. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we did our percussion layers, and I did all this really cool mm-hmm. chanting with these vocalists, and we did all these different layers of rhythmic levels and all these other musical levels with strings and different types of instruments. So as you got into battle, the actual tracks would actually escalate up, and then as it would come down, it would come back down. So it wouldn't, you know, you don't mm-hmm. get that sort of huge mixing problem right. because it actually is scaling.
It's scaling.
On.
God damn it! I'm gonna have to go buy this damn game.
But the problem
you're gonna
was,
play it. You're like, the game's terrible. Wow, the music is fantastic.
And that's how we would write. You know, when you're writing a score for a movie, and then you can bring in more instrumentation as something's yeah. building and building and building. But then at the same time, the technology you're streaming. I mean, even right now, if we're doing, you know, a stereo stream, that's pretty taxing on a machine to do 16 stereo mm-hmm. streams, all encoded with surround. For any game system right now is still really difficult. And a lot of times you find them, they're collapsing it down to mono, they're compressing it, they're doing all sorts of things. So you're knocking down the fidelity, and it just at the end of it, it's just sort of like, yeah, it's a great idea, but we're not there yet. And a couple projects will get away with it, but they're going to have to sacrifice something else in the visuals or something else in terms of just how much they can store in. So unfortunately, on that project, we ended up having to go back and actually more thematically sort of designed the battle sequences, and I wanted to have sort of more ambient areas as you're exploring the levels, and sort of taking that approach where instead of building up this way, we're sort of building out, you know, this way. So we're going more based on the interaction as opposed to the intensity of that's what's going there. And unfortunately, that means that you're sort of canning certain elements, which you are not as interactive.
Risking this maybe exploding to a longer conversation for all of
that's
us.
That's a good thing.
Do you see, since you're the expert here, do you see what do you see as the future in video game and sound? What is there anything interesting that you see in the horizon that interests you?
Especially
or
with like
you?
Natal coming out.
Well, and by the same token, do you see the same sort of evolution happening in movies, which seems a little bit more static to me?
Well, I think the problem with films is that the home theater market has gotten so fantastic.
Yeah, why leave?
That, like, I mean, I would rather watch most movies here in
well,
our stage
I would too.
In the theater, unless it's going to be something where it's going to be like a, you know, a Lord of the Rings or something, you know, an epic film where I'm going to go to one of the best places. I'm going to go to the Arclight. I'll go to someplace else, and I want to see a film there because it's just there's a different experience when you have 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 people around you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember seeing Private Ryan. There's a great theater down in Orange County down by, I think it's Fashion Island, and it's the largest screen west of the Mississippi. It holds like 2,000 people. It's enormous.
Wow.
It's bigger than an IMAX screen. It's amazing. And the problem is it is so blaringly loud at the first half of the theater because to amplify the speakers, you actually have to sit back a bit to get that balance of the speakers. So there's blasting to hit 2,000 people, right?
Yeah, the first eight rows look like the Maxell commercial.
It is.
In the chair.
It literally is, but it's a great place to see stuff. And if you're going to see, you know, a Star Wars, or you're going to see a Lord of the Rings. And I actually saw, we used to see a lot of the big films there, but when Private Ryan came out, Saving Private Ryan, it was in DTS, and we saw it there. Have 2,000 people watching that opening
warfare.
Sequence.
Warfare. Jeez. That was brutal.
It is really brutal. And to have emotional impact of having that many people around you is phenomenal. And you don't get that.
I actually sat in the movie theater watching the audience watch that scene. And if you've ever seen a cat around a sound that's too loud with its ears sort of pressed against its head, I've never seen like 2,000 people with their ears pressed against their head kind of hunkering down in terror.
Yeah.
You know,
and I would rather see a film either with every single seat empty or every single seat packed. I don't like
I
it where you got like 10 guys and one guy's eating his popcorn because you get distracted with just a few people in the theater or there's someone's answering their phone or whatever. But when you get 2,000 people in every single opening night of a huge film, there's a dynamic when people laugh at the same jokes or they cheer at the same things. There's just that emotional impact that you can't get at home.
It can work in the other direction. I have to share real quick. I went to see Mortal Kombat 2 at the biggest theater in New York City on opening night. Nobody knew. Okay, so yeah, the opening theme starts up, and like it's a room filled with guys in their early 20s just like, yeah! 10 minutes in, the entire theater is like, yeah. About half an hour, there's like one guy in the background going,
Johnny Cage.
Yeah. But I've never, like, it's the first time I've ever had an environment where the entire communal experience was of dragging people down.
Oh, man. I went to go see that movie in Brooklyn, and people were throwing milkshakes at the screen.
Yeah. Sorry. Anyway.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about, so just for the pure geek joy factor, some of the other things that you've worked on in terms of the games?
So, well, starting off when I was doing that early Genesis stuff, I started just working really, really fast. I did the whole score for BattleTech in seven days. And they had a guy that was working on it for like 9 months. So when I could do this in a week, they were like, oh, here, here. And so I started just doing games like crazy. And at that time,
that's a precedent you don't want.
Yeah,
to set too.
it was a dangerous thing, but it was actually, for me, it was great because I work fast. I know, and for me, the technology shouldn't interfere with the creativity. So I started doing tons and tons of games, and I was approached by Virgin Interactive, and I started working on their games. And I was only doing four games a year. I was going to do Clive Barker's Ectosphere, which was a game that never saw the light of day. It was an amazing game, and a game called Toonstruck that they had been working on, that they'd started working on there.
Also and never saw the light.
That one, actually, the first half did. And actually, the first half was amazing, but the game was so big and it had taken 4 years that they cut it in half. And they said, okay, well, let's sequel it with the other half of the game and successful. And game was critically successful.
Acclaimed, but disappeared.
It just disappeared. Huh. But anyway, so I was only hired on to do these four projects. And the first thing I was doing, I was working on a Jungle Book for Disney's Jungle Book, and they had hired me to do some music for it, and I was supposed to do all these sound effects and all this music, and I had like 6 months to work on this project. And at the end of the first week, I came back to the head guy and said, okay, here's all the stuff, what else you got? And he was like, I don't have anything. And I was already on staff, and so I started going to our external developers and I said, do you guys have any more projects? I got a studio here. And I mean, I was using – I had brought all of my equipment that I had amassed from all this other stuff to do these games. And so I did games like Creature Shock. That was one of the first ones, which was an amazing early game. And had that come out before Doom, that would have been the defining game. But Doom – that game slipped and Doom came out and that was it. Everyone knew Doom and then Quake and everything from there. Hmm. So I started doing about
– same branding issue you were talking about earlier.
Exactly.
The first thing there.
First thing that hits and people hear it and then they just know that first. Right. And then anything else seems like it's a ripoff of that.
Maybe you should change your band's name to BioShock.
Wait. Yeah, steal some of those guys.
Well, so
those fans.
Where's the guy in the deep wetsuit?
What happened? The music is awesome.
But back to your question, so I ended up doing 20, 30, 40 games a year for and Virgin Interactive, which is the company I started working for, they were the third largest publisher in the United States for games in the 90s, but they were the first largest in Europe. So what they were doing is they were developing a handful of titles internally, but then they would hire all these other game developers to do games for them, and they would publish them. So I started doing all their work. So that's how I started getting involved. So by the time Virgin had grown and we were bought by Viacom, we were part of the Spelling and Blockbuster and Paramount family, we were just doing all these games. So, and I became the audio director for Virgin and I was in charge of all those games. So that set in motion this huge sort of library of games that I was directing. And what was amazing about that was all these games were coming in and they would say, they'd start bringing in celebrities to do the voices and I'd come in and I was like, oh, who's directing them? And they looked at me and they're like, You're the audio guy. And I was like, okay, Mr. Tim Curry. And that's how I started learning how to direct. And so by the time 99, EA came in and bought out Virgin, and I became the audio director for Virgin, for EA for their Pacific division out here in Los Angeles. And after a year, I just said, I just got to do my own thing. And I just left. And so about 8-9 years ago, started PCB. And first project out was Ridge Racer for Nintendo. And then all of a sudden that started snowballing. And I was already had 30 clients lined up because we were publishing 30 different games that now needed audio services. Virgin was folded into EA. EA was doing their own things. And so that took off. And games like Thrill Kill, which I don't know if you guys have ever seen Thrill Kill. It's the guys who ended up doing – I mean, they did this fantastic titles. But this game, this team, Paradox, was developing the first four-person fighter for the PlayStation. And it was this very, very brutal game, Thrill Kill, that we were working on. And my band Contagion was doing the soundtrack. We'd done all the sound design. Virgin was working on this, publishing this game. And it was so violent. It was so over-the-top violent that it was just banned. I mean, everyone was just banning this thing. And EA was under a lot of pressure from the government because a lot of their games were getting a lot of just...
Wait a second. Okay, so if he doesn't rip the guy's eyeball out and eat it, can we get a better rating? No. No, you can't.
Yeah, literally, like, one of the kill moves would be they had a guy, Dr. Faustus, and he was this doctor with this huge, like, bear trap mouth, and he would bend you over, pull inside from the rear entry...
He would fist you?
And pull out your heart. And that was his kill move. Yes. It was that kind of game.
I want this game.
It was, fist kill.
Yes. So
fatality.
Fistality.
And actually, literally a week before.
Wow,
the
you
game,
you broke Peter.
Yeah. It was wow. A fantastic title.
Peter just like went into a little fetal crouch.
My eyes are tearing.
Got a little video.
That was a really strong wince.
So with glorious games like that that never saw the light of day, literally it was a week away from shipping, and we had sold the Virgin sold out to EA, and EA is like, well, and
it doesn't
sound
like an EA title.
No, it really wasn't. So they actually flushed the entire game, and then wouldn't even let it be sold. It was done. The game was finished.
Interesting choice of verb.
Flush.
But if you guys find it, it is actually the largest black marketed video game ever.
What platform was it for?
PlayStation.
Remember? I gotta find this. Yeah. I still
have Dodd.
Oh, if you guys
I need to find this.
Just look up Thrill Kill.
Dodd's gonna come back in, like
Thrill Kill.
Geek's eye is gonna be like three shades whiter. I just beat Thrill Kill. I feel dirty.
But since then, got into a couple lighter games. But I ended up doing.
Before or after that you did Jungle Book?
I think it was a little after. Disney was pretty much done at that point.
Well, it seems like you are working with EA again.
Yeah, I've been working. I work for EA, 2K, THQ, Activision, Ubisoft. I work with pretty much all the largest publishers doing stuff for Sony.
And that's the Prince of Persia, the BioShock. Did you work on BioShock?
I worked on the BioShock.
Did you do the score for BioShock?
Did the original, all the dialogue recording for the first round of the game.
Oh, really? Dude.
Yeah, those guys are great. Fantastic.
That was a lot
team.
Of dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they did most of the other stuff back at their offices as well, but when it first started off. And it was amazing because even we had the...
Are you working on two?
Can't say.
Damn you.
You know what would improve that game, though? Peter's wife, Tracy. Just saying.
I think Matt Yankig would improve that game.
Maybe. But the strongest franchises continue to get stronger every year. And that's the thing about, you know, if you look at movies and sequels, it's like most sequels don't do as well. Video games, sequels, always better.
Right.
Always stronger and more marketing and more exposure and that kind of stuff. So,
do you think that weakens the market or strengthens it?
What's that?
The sequel. Because it is a very fattest thing with video games. They know that the sequel does incredibly well. You like the first one, you'll love the second one.
Well, I'm directing Modern Warfare 2 right now. And what's amazing about that is that that's Call of Duty 6, but it's not a continuation of Call of Duty 5.
Right.
So when I started working on that franchise, I did Call of Duty 2 and the team, Infinity Ward, that did that was working on the Xbox 360 and the PC version of it, and at the same time the Treyarch guys were working on the Big Red One version of Call of Duty 2. And at that point most people didn't know the difference between the Xbox and the Xbox 360, and it was very early for that. So when Call of Duty 2 came out, most people saw the PlayStation and the Xbox version, not the actual Infinity Ward version.
Right.
So then that team also did Call of Duty 3. All in the meanwhile, we were working on Call of Duty 4, which is Modern Warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And so when 4 came out, I don't think anyone was really expecting it, and it just was a sleeper hit. I mean, people still love the Call of Duty franchise, but I don't think they were ready for the jump because most people hadn't seen Call of Duty 2.
There was a weirdness. I actually worked on the first Call of Duty.
On the first one?
The very first one for PC.
Yeah.
And the first expansion pack. And because of the the virtually simultaneous release of Call of Duty 2 and on Xbox and PC as two separate versions.
Right.
It actually confused the franchise.
People totally got
very confused as to what they were playing.
Right. And that's what happened with 3 into 4.
Yeah.
And now with 4 into 5, because 4 is Modern Warfare, right? So that's all modern day, great. And then 5 comes out, and 5's developed back by the other team, by Treyarch.
Yeah.
And that goes back to World War II.
And I don't think people also realize that was when they started they're leapfrogging that franchise with those two different companies, and that's when that first started. Right. And I think people are like, "What? That the other one came out last year. How is this one on top of it?" And it's not. Yeah. I think you're right. It did,
which also led to weird speaking internally, we weren't allowed to discuss what was going on with our version of the game with the other group that was developing the other version of the game, which created some strange conflicts.
You know, and that's like, and that's always the problem. And both teams are great. I've done maybe about 15 titles for Treyarch, and I've been working with Infinity Ward for the past 4 or 5 years, and those guys are fantastic.
Well, Modern Warfare came out and bitch slapped everybody because that is a super popular title. Yeah. I mean, it is
number one selling game. It is like top selling game ever. Yeah,
and it's still like the number one online game.
Yeah.
And the sequels, they were, you know, E3, they already had footage from the sequel, and I don't think anyone's done playing the first one.
Right.
Well, and that's what happened is, and what was interesting is that when Call of Duty 5 came out, people are like, "Oh, cool, Call of Duty 5," and all of a sudden, like, "Whoa, World War II!" Now it's a great game. Right. It's the other team, but it's a fantastic game. It's using the same engine, from my understanding.
Pacific
conflict.
Yeah.
And so the sales of 5 have been fantastic, but I think what's interesting is now with Modern Warfare 2, it's technically Call of Duty 6, but really, as far as the team that you know started it, this is Modern Warfare 2, and that's how they're positioning it. So I think that's sort of the way that they're
the parallel universe thing.
Yeah, now Call of Duty is here and Modern Warfare is there, and they're both. I mean, they're great franchises, but I think that's a great way that they've been able to sort of differentiate them.
Now, there's something that really interests me, especially being on the recording side of it, is that in a lot of the recordings that I've done for voiceover recently, they're asking for more and more and more and more. And actually, a lot of times, can you improv in the room? Can you do these things? Because everybody's heading towards so much of the immersive environment, you know, especially with things like Grand Theft Auto, you know, which was so immersive. I mean, everybody had a voice. Do you find that more difficult to do what you're doing now? That it's just that's the requirement?
In terms of the volume?
Yeah, the volume of what you're recording and what's required of the writers and stuff like that, just to put that much information.
It's tremendous.
Out.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, a half-hour television show is about 400 lines of dialogue, right? For a half-hour TV show. If you look at about a motion picture, it's about 1,200 to 1,500 lines of dialogue. Call of Duty, the last one, we had about 36,000 lines of dialogue.
And that's not an open world.
No.
Like, you know, these days, even in open world environments where you generally give certain things, you're willing to give certain things up because it's open world. If you hear a piece of dialogue too many times, it feels like a dated video game already.
Right.
And that used to be like...
Yeah, like Oblivion is still one of my favorite RPGs, but like I just want to bitch slap freaking every single female orc every time she opens her mouth now.
I mean, those games must have hundreds of thousands of lines of dialogue, and you still, if you hear it twice, you go, eh.
Well, a lot of it was the technology. I mean, if you think about how much they could store on a disc before, there just wasn't that much space. Yeah. I mean, a PlayStation 1 had, like, I mean, figure like what we're recording at right now, it's uncompressed. We're doing 10 megabytes per minute at 16-bit 44 kilohertz. So for 1 minute, that's going to be 10 megabytes. In the PlayStation 1, the entire sound budget for everything, sound effects, music, anything that wasn't streaming off the disc was 1 meg.
Yeah.
So you had basically a tenth of a minute for all the sounds for everything that was there. Yeah. Now, you could stream off the disc, but that's also where all the content's coming from and everything else that's there. And then the PlayStation 2, 2 megabytes. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how do you look at, you know, creating this sort of home theater experience of a cinematic experience with 2 megabytes of sound memory? And so from a sound guy's perspective, that's just death. Now, Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, obviously we have a lot more memory, but not a tremendous amount more, 32 megs, maybe 64 megs. So you can still do quite a bit, and you can stream a lot. And with DVDs and Blu-rays now, you can actually stream in a lot of stuff and be very creative about it. But the problem is that, and I think that what you're finding with all the next-gen systems is that there's not the capacity to fill these discs with the amount of stuff that they actually can do now. So with that dialogue and
wondering with these now that, you know, I'm wondering if online streaming content with things like dialogue, new dialogue is going to start showing up where you pop in a disc, or maybe you don't, maybe it's completely downloaded, but let's say you pop in a traditional disc and it's getting content through, you know, an offline site, where like you can add new dialogue or things that couldn't fit on a disc is being streamed in. I wonder if that's going to start showing up more.
Well, a lot of the downloadable content you're seeing for a lot of the expansion packs right now, they're doing that. They'll have a server. Either they'll have stuff on the disc that unlocks or they have stuff that streams down. There's different ramifications in terms of the unions and how they pay for that content.
Well,
Or how many people they can
That's the issue with the unions right now, is that the unions are so far technologically behind. They don't understand what's coming.
At all.
Therefore, they don't understand how to set up a pricing scheme.
Right.
And, you know, they're just trying to protect their actors' rights, which I respect being an actor. But you can't say we have... Well, we just hired 15,000 actors or whatever it is. You know, we've hired, you know, 2,000 actors. We can't pay every single one of them residuals and still maintain money on the whole project.
Well, the same thing happened with the writer's strike, too, in terms of, you know, looking at where the future of online is. And I agree that that issue needs to be pressed right now because obviously that's there. But people haven't figured it out on either side yet.
Right.
And the problem is that pushing for it right now or locking into something is actually doing harm for both sides. Right.
That being said, you look at the game like Castlevania, which just came out, and they're using Patrick Stewart and like that to promote the game.
Right.
That's where I'm like, okay, well, pay Patrick Stewart some residuals if you're using his name in front of titles to promote the game.
Well, and that's right now, in terms of if you look at how celebrities are being utilized in video games, it's primarily used through marketing.
Right.
It's not necessarily for content. And this is no disrespect to any celebrities, because I work with a ton every week, and some of them are some of the best voice actors around. But a lot of times they're brought in because they have a marketing value for the project.
But that's why they're brought into movies, too.
True. Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially foreign sales and that kind of stuff.
Butts and seats.
If you don't have some kind of celebrity name.
But if you can't, you know, not everybody necessarily has the ear to go, oh, that's Michael Dorn, you know. But if you do a Star Trek game and you say, okay, Michael Dorn's going to be in this
like,
game someplace.
Yeah, but like Jack Bauer is in the
Call of Duty 5.
Call of Duty.
Right.
And they didn't have to get him to, you know, but they advertise. Hey, guess
but they
what?
Know, right, in that.
Yeah, Sutherland is in, you know, Call of Duty 5.
But I think that what you're finding now is that
I bought Wing Commander for Mark Hamill.
but that's the thing, is a lot of those guys are, I mean, Mark is actually an amazing voice actor.
He's an incredible voice actor.
He's fantastic.
He's an odd dude, but he's an incredible voice actor.
He doesn't have a lisp.
No.
No. No.
We did a little thing about 12 years ago, and he had this lisp we couldn't get rid of.
He's incredible. I watch him do his work.
We just did,
had a tooth infection or something.
We just did Darksiders with him, and he was phenomenal. Just amazing.
No, I've heard he was great. And
he comes off the chain. I mean, he pulls some stuff out that, I mean, just when he did the Joker for the Batman series, was unbelievable.
Same thing, exactly.
Unbelievable.
I think we should move into
the new stuff.
The new stuff.
Yeah.
Let's leave the music behind us.
Well, and that was actually the one thing I really had wanted to do with from a career standpoint, was that, you know, like I did Tony Hawk 2, sold like 10 million copies, right? Mm-hmm. Did the music, sound effects, brought in all the actors, did that kind of stuff. If I sold an album that had one song, if I was on like a soundtrack that sold 10 million
copies,
right? A million is platinum. So if it was 10 times platinum for an album, I could buy all the houses on this block, right? But in a video game, everything's work for hire. Same thing you were talking about earlier with actors. As a composer, as a sound engineer, as an audio director, as a voice director, as any kind of talent director, the game industry right now is where the film industry was 75 years ago.
Right.
And again, that's no disrespect. It's just the structure of the way the system works right now. Mm-hmm. So with everything being a work for hire, if I do Call of Duty and sells 10, 15 million units – that's all.
What I want to know is where that money is going. Is it just reinvestment into property to build up the you know, to build up the next level of technology, to build up the next level of game?
Have you seen how big EA is?
Well, yeah, I mean,
somebody's rich.
The video game industry is still one of the most ostentatious industries around right now. The amount of money they lay out to earn more business is fascinating to me. You know,
but for someone who's creating projects, or someone will come to me with a sketch of a character and ask me to write something or direct something or build a property around that, and then just to be a work for hire and go off, that's fine for a lot of people because they just need the work, and there's tons of people coming out of school. And, one of the reasons I've kind of shied away from doing a lot of music recently, even though my whole background for 15 years was scoring movies and games and albums, was that there's these guys right out of school that are fantastic that are working for free. Because they're like, hey, I just want the experience. I want to work on a big video game. And these guys are like, well, I could either get this guy who's been around for 15 years and has got these credits, but he's not Danny Elfman or he's not, you know, Hans Zimmer. But he's really, really good. But he's going to cost me this much. Or I can get this guy who might not be quite as good, but stuff sounds pretty good and it's free. You know, and they're
it's
like
take him twice as long, but he's one tenth the cost.
Right. Yeah. And so the problem is that they might chew that guy up, spit him out, and he may get out of the business or go on or not do whatever. Mm-hmm. But that one game is now gone. And so for the 30 games, there's one that's now I'm not scoring. Right.
Same thing with the actors who are totally willing to do non-union.
But exactly. For you, you don't have ownership of that content. And so
is that what shoved you into wanting to do?
And that was exactly why I realized that I needed to create original content, because that's what I'm doing for my clients anyway,
right?
But I'm not.
You're not owning your
own
original
stuff. I don't
own any
of that IP. And it's a horrible example. But if you look at something like any of the remakes that are going, I mean, look at anything. Pick a movie that's been around. You know that franchise. I mean, a friend of mine is they're remaking right now. Right, it's going to be a huge budget, and you know, fantastic that they're going to be going back to that franchise. But
are they going back to the original books? They are.
But
he's going to be smart.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. And the people involved in it are doing a really, you know, a lot of great research.
Good.
I don't know how much of this is going to be disclosed yet. So, but we have a lot of great people that are working on that right now. And fantastic franchise. But how old, you know, that franchise is still existing. And his heirs are still not part of that. Mm-hmm. And if you look at any of these films that are coming back out, they're just regurgitating these properties that are around,
again,
which is great for
the property holders.
Exactly. And
it's
safe.
Full of it.
And it's safe for the studios because, oh, well, hey, this is proven, right? We've done this before. Let's go and take something out of our vaults and be able to do something. So it's harder and harder for original IP to find a way. For people to create an original property and actually develop it, it's harder for the studios to invest in it because there's no track record for it.
And beyond that, I've had literally at this point, I think I'm at 4 ideas this year that have been turned down by major video game companies, all of them with the same comment, we would love to play this, but it's too innovative.
Yeah.
Too innovative.
Yeah, when
so you want to run your own content into the ground.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much. That's a well put way to
exactly.
Got it. I understand that completely.
But I mean,
look at your distribution model. I mean, the thing is, you said I'm going to put out a $50 book, you know, leather bound. It's going to be pretty with incredible art, and people will buy it. That if you would pitch that to any Marvel, DC, you know, Image.
No.
If you had pitched that, you would have gotten a no. You would have gotten a big fat no.
And that's what happened. So what happened with Ascend, so this going back to where we started with this dream that I had, I hooked up with Christopher. I basically, on my own dime, I financed all these storyboards for the film. So I was writing the story. I broke it down into 3 acts. I was going to basically structure the whole screenplay with boards. And I was working on a video game, and a friend of mine hooked me up with Jimmy Palamati, who's a big comic book writer, had worked at Marvel back in the day, and now is very successful, still doing his own comic books, worked on the 28 Days Later books. He's worked Punisher, I mean, the original Punisher, a lot of the original stuff, you know, going
not
back.
Not Punisher, the we're going to always take the easiest story in the entire world and screw it up Punisher?
No.
Okay, good.
But taking those types of properties and then learning from that. So I met with Jimmy, and I was saying, hey, I was showing him, you know, these storyboards, and he goes, these aren't storyboards, dude. This is a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
And so he put me in touch with the guys at Image, and literally the next day, after showing them like 5 of the pages, I had a contract from Image to do the graphic novel. And I'd never written a graphic novel before. I mean, and quite honestly, the only graphic novel that I had really gravitated towards was Arkham Asylum, the original Batman one. And that everything was so amazing because everything was painted. Every single panel. You look at Sandman or any of the other things, the covers are fantastic, and you go inside and it's just a different art style. Now, no disrespect to those franchises.
That's what it is. That's what his artwork harkens back to. It's the covers of Sandman, of the covers of the Sandman novels.
And Keane and all those guys were just such fantastic artists that I wanted every single page to be cover worthy.
Brilliant.
That was my goal. And so when we went to Image was like, Wow. I mean, the whole book. And they also mainly traditionally have done comic books, not graphic novels. Mm-hmm. So, so I was going to Comic-Con, and I actually paid to have a booth at Comic-Con, and I'd been going there for years. So I got there and started showing the artwork that we were doing and instantly being flooded because people saw the quality of the artwork. They heard the story. They knew what we were doing. And there was this buzz that was building on it. So by the time I released the trade paperback version of Ascend, not this hardcover version, came out about 3-4 years ago, and when it came out on the fourth day, when we did our first sign, we did a big signing over at Meltdown Comics. The fourth day the book was out, the entire 5-year print run was sold out nationwide. And I couldn't even, I mean, even at the signing, they couldn't even sell any books to them. We had to give them our personal books so people could have signed books.
So
because they weren't available.
How did you get the word? I mean, it wasn't just Comic-Con. Like, what?
It was primarily Comic-Con and through people knowing through my website.
I'm always curious about really how much how Comic-Con really works for companies, if it's just kind of a thing to show up and be a presence, or is it really
if it's quality, it'll rise.
I think what happens, the thing is that if you think about Comic-Con is the hardest audience to please, right? It's now video games, it's movies, it's obviously comic books and graphic novels, there's toys, every sort of part of our culture that we're all into, right?
If you were born in 70 or later.
Right.
But you can't just please those people. What those people have to do is talk.
Right.
Otherwise Comic-Con still isn't enough people. So you have to get everyone to Comic-Con to see you,
right,
and you have to have a great comic, but then this is the question is,
but again,
are
I believe
Comic-Con
that's creating
the people who spread the word.
But again, I believe that's creating obstructions. You know, if it's a good product, I believe it will rise.
Well, it does seem to be like my observation, like the mainstream stuff doesn't actually seem to get much benefit from Comic-Con. Because it's like, oh, Marvel's doing another X-Men arc where they kill a major X-Men character.
But the writers and like artists are really
cool. But on the other hand, indie stuff, my pick from the last time I went, I think 3 years ago, was Trailer Park of Terror was my favorite comic of that year. They got a movie deal out of being there.
Right.
You know, the indies do well.
The Goon was this comic that I just picked up, and I thought it was such brilliant artwork. Next thing I know, absolutely, graphic novel, movie deal.
As a creator, the thing is that if I was to take a screenplay, graphic novel, and I want to option that book to a film studio, I have to go to Sony, I have to go to Warner Brothers, I have to go to Fox, I have to go to Paramount, I have to set up a meeting, I have to go meet with them, pitch them, show them the artwork, tell them the story, go through that, take the meeting, then get a response. I mean, and just to pitch to that level, and I'm on their turf, and I'm sort of doing that. At Comic-Con, I just put up my backdrop, put out the books, let the fans see it, everyone can see what's there. But all those industry people are coming down, so they actually come.
They're
to
looking
me,
for you,
and they look, and they come, and they can walk by, and they say, "You know what? That's not my style. I don't like that." Or they're like, "That's exactly what we're looking for." And all of our deals, everything that I do, is all revolves around Comic-Con now.
That's great.
Because what happens is, and this year is the largest; they're expecting 250,000 people. It's already been sold out for the past 4 months.
Entirely sold out. Yeah. It's not like last year where they had a one-day Sunday pass left. There's nothing left.
Nothing at all. Right. Yeah. And that's what's so fantastic about it. And my whole – and this gets into some of the stuff we were talking about, ARGs and some of the, and way I'm positioning my projects, is because of my background in music, my background in sound, my background in – I've done internet and mobile and obviously all these video games for console and PC. But I've been doing movies. I've done television shows. I direct a ton of stuff for Japanese anime, all these different areas. So my love of technology and creativity have sort of now channeled into my own projects. And I said, well, I'm not just creating a book. The idea is that these are what I call transmedia properties. And the idea is that instead of – and if you look at any other franchise that's out there, if you look at Iron Man, you look at Spider-Man, you look at any of the other big comic book properties, anything else like that, they'll take the same story, the same characters, and they just regurgitate them, say, okay, here's the comic book, here's the movie, here's the video game, here's the website. It's all the same story. It's all the same characters, exactly the same thing. But you look at the video game, like I worked on the Spider-Man video games, and again, great teams, fantastic franchise. We had to follow the same content from the movie without the benefit of working with Sam, without the benefit of working with all the same writers, without the same art directors. And the game's still great, still plays great, but the game was really, in my opinion, about 7-8 months from, you know, on the first one, about 7 or 8 months from being truly finished and polished. Sure. We had to come out day and date with the film because the film is coming out and that's the marketing push, right? And everyone's going to see that. And I mean, if you look at any other kind of release, if you miss the film release where there's, you know, print advertising hundreds of millions of dollars worldwide to push a franchise, and then, oh yeah, about 8 months later the game came out, like, oh yeah, you've moved on. But when the big summer event is this film and the game comes out with it, of course you're going to go and buy the video game if you're into the movie and you like video games and that is the characters and everything else. Just based on the marketing of the movie, you're probably going to buy the video game, right?
Right.
And Spider-Man, the first one's 4 or 5 million copies. Fantastic, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's great sales for a video game. The game wasn't really
The game was done. Mediocre.
Right.
But that's how franchise video games unfortunately get.
Yeah. And well, now they're doing that with like WALL-E, the video game, which was like piss poor.
EA held off on Superman because it was just not done.
Yeah, it was an atrocious game.
Like, you could not. Well, and they.
It was redundant.
It took,
too. Same thing.
It took another 8 months, I think, to get that one out after the movie.
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, as sequels come out and as the newer Spider-Man games have come out and all, the technology gets
been
better.
Good.
And, you know, Spider-Man 2 was so much better than Spider-Man 1.
Much.
And still did better numbers. And it's great. And, and I think over the years, a lot of the publishers have kind of learned that. But the problem is, a game takes it easily 2 years to develop a decent game, mm-hmm. right? Whereas a film, once it gets greenlit, goes into production, is going to be about a year and a half. So to go backwards, plan the video game, have the script, have that creative talent, all the people together, and have all that foresight to then come together and catch up with the movie and then release day and date and have them both be good, I don't know how many on less than one hand I can probably tell you which ones have been decent. And if you look at films like...
Less than one finger.
Yeah. But if you look at like what they tried to do with The Matrix, right? So The Matrix, here you had an amazing first film. You know,
thank you for that.
Questionable second, but the idea was, and I'd been preaching this to a lot of the guys internally at Virgin and EA and a lot of people for a long time, is that if you can start the story here, because the film is a linear content, right?
Right.
That's a linear experience. You're going to sit back and watch, and there's zero interactivity. And what's amazing about movies is that it's about the characters. It's about, you know, feeling that suspension of disbelief that you are actually watching this thing. You love these characters, and you're emotionally bonding with everything that you're seeing there. The thing about video games is you are those characters,
right?
And the world is the star, not the characters. And if you look at a franchise like Star Wars, the reason why Star Wars has lasted for so many years compared to any other franchise is it's not because of Luke. It's not because of Darth Vader or Han Solo or any one of those individual characters. It's because that universe is cool and you want to know,
right?
Where did Boba Fett come from? Where did Han Solo, you know, where?
It's an intersection of many different stories.
And that was the problem with the first three films, is he betrayed the universe.
And I think that's what was so interesting.
Midichlorians. Sorry. Let's move on.
But that's how you can have successful franchises or merchandise or video games that continue to come out. How many Star Wars films come out each year, right? How many different variations? Because the world is still holding all those characters. And so going back to what I'm trying to do is my feeling is it creating transmedia franchises is really where the future is, because what you're doing is and especially I think my background in video games is pushing me to that, because we create worlds in video games because we want great linear content. We want strong characters that we can identify with, but we have to be those characters, so that world has to be able to support dozens or hundreds of hours of gameplay, not 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit, it's a very difficult challenge as a writer to be writing for 10, 20, 50 hours of gameplay and then write a 90-minute script. It is a really big challenge because there's so much you want to put in. What I have in Ascend is so beyond gigantic. To throw that into a 90-minute film is such a challenge. And we're doing it, but it is really, really hard.
But you could put it in – you have your comic book. You have your slice of the world in your movie. You could put out your traditional role-playing game with all the background in there.
And that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. And that's how transmedia should work.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just regurgitate that same story on all these different platforms, the game for Ascend is the prequel.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads up to the moment. And actually, not to betray anything.
Is it a game?
As much as I can say, yes.
Oop.
But the idea is...
You heard it here first on Geeks On.
Books on investigative reports.
But that's the idea, and we actually go backwards on that franchise. And what's interesting is that Ascend, and I work on video games, obviously, like Dead Speed, the new one that's coming out right now, is a fantastic video game concept. Just the concept of the idea that what happens in Dead Speed, just to kind of tangent.
No, this is the new comic you're premiering next month at Comic-Con.
Yes. So I have two books that are coming out, Infex and Deadspeed.
Infex is a really cool... I mean, is that not
so much a graphic novel as a weapon.
Is that your marketing right there?
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like...
That is. It's a metal cover.
It looks like a metal cover, solid, beautiful art.
You could actually use this to fend off zombies.
It looks like a laptop.
I saw something... You had a preview of this last year?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've seen that book before.
We had the first, like, 400 or 500 copies at Comic-Con last year, and the shipment came in damaged, and so we couldn't sell the whole thing, and we sold out instantly, like, because everyone was waiting for the book to come out. And so we released the book actually came out in February of this year, but we didn't release it to stores, so we actually held it for Comic-Con.
Okay, so this is the full release.
This is the full release of it, right.
Got it.
Okay. And then same thing. Deadspeed is another one I've been working on for a couple of years. Same artist on Deadspeed as Ascend, Christopher.
And what's the premise of Deadspeed? You're commenting about the video game concept.
So the great part about Deadspeed is that this basically takes place a dozen years after a pandemic has wiped out 99.9% of society.
Of course.
And the last outpost of humanity is held up within this prison compound, Rossmore Prison in Chicago, old Chicago. And what's happened is what kept the bad guys in these prisons basically kept the zombies out that have destroyed everything else. And so the ex-convicts, the former inmates that are – they're allowed their freedom by becoming these things called rippers. And all they're given is just a shotgun, a machete, and a cooler chest. And these guys have to take these sort of souped-up fast cars, go out beyond outside of the prison walls and find down bodies that haven't quite – died yet, and they have to hack out a spleen or some kind of organ to bring back for transplant for the survivors that are still dying at the in the compound. And that's sort of their currency of survival. And he ends up finding this girl that is actually not just sort of the cure, but she is sort of the origin behind this. And so this story is this pretty – I mean, just when you get zombies and cars together, I mean, you just can't go wrong. But the idea is for a video game, the idea is that we have time-sensitive gameplay of going out and, you know, finding these bodies, hacking these organs, bringing them back. And then that's actually just the first third of the story, and then it kind of goes on from there. Hmm. But in a video game world, you know, you have 20-minute levels. You've got this sort of immersive environment where you can sort of go on – you're not on just rails. You can actually go in a lot of different ways.
Great.
But that makes a perfect video game just because of the environment and the types of things that are there. When I look at something like Ascend, where it's you've got these angels and demons that are harvesting souls on Earth to reinforce their legions in the Purgatory Wars to fight this never-ending battle, that's cool. But the story itself is sort of that's set on that backdrop, and it becomes this family drama and this battle between brothers. So the actual motion picture property itself of Ascend, I would never pitch as a video game. But the backdrop and the Purgatory Wars and all the battle between that, that's a fantastic video game. So as a creator, you have to look at your properties and say, this won't – because you go to a studio and they're going to say, okay, great. Here's the movie. Here's the game. Here's the comic book. We're just going to keep repurposing it for each of those different sort of mediums. And I'm saying, no, actually, we have to spread this out. We want to tell the backstory here. This is going to be linear content that's going to focus on the characters here. The interactive side is going to be here. The mobile and the gameplay is going to be
smart.
Here. Each one of those are mutually exclusive. You can read the comic book, and you can have a great experience. You can watch the movie, you can have a great experience. And if you bring them all together, then you have a much more immersive experience. But the idea is that it's not only transmedia because it exists on those, but it's taking advantage of what each – like sort of what I was talking about earlier with technology with sound cards, right? Do what's best for a graphic novel and don't try to make it what it's not. Don't try to make a movie a video game. Let a movie be a movie. Let the characters breathe. Tell a story that's good for a movie environment and let a game be good for a game. Don't just try to repurpose the film in the game.
Yeah.
That's the idea in doing true transmedia. And then on top of that, to then sort of encompass all of those is the idea of doing ARGs. And I think that's what's the best part about it.
So the ARG is sort of a connective tissue, if you will.
Absolutely.
Because those of us who are coming in late, ARGs is alternate reality game.
Yeah, and alternate reality game, if you think about it in terms of Halo, like I Love Bees, where there is a website which basically brought you into different aspects and eventually led you to further content down the line. So you're saying the ARG in this case would be something that would lead you to the different aspects of your world.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And to me, viral marketing is the most important
aspect of anything right now. Because print advertising, commercial advertising on television, all the other things are really dying.
Yes.
It's not that I don't have a love for watching great, you know, ads if they're done well, but I watch them for the creativity, not because I want someone to tell me how cool they are, how great their product is.
Right. It's becoming stop selling me. You know, it's basically because we live in a global village, the rumor mill is once again back up.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's more interesting
I'm going to trust what my friend tells me and probably discount anything my television set tells me.
Right. Yeah. If you tell me how great you are, I'm like, all right, okay. If you tell me how great he is, then all of a sudden I'm like, well, wow, he must be great because someone else has told me about.
I wouldn't really do that.
Ow.
But that's the idea is that you're going to take your friend's word over any kind of thing because that's just sort of the idea is that you want to sort of associate and be able to bond.
Well, there's also
I think we are of a generation where there's no bigger turnoff than someone trying to sell himself.
Absolutely.
But there's also
you can tell 1,000 different ways when they do it. You know?
There's also a new thing, which is internet fever. Which is this new and now a marketing tool because people have tapped into this is that when there's a buzz that happens on the internet that sells products or gets people interested in things and who knows how those things get started. Companies have actually been able to use it, and it's very rare to start a meme or start but it has happened.
Did you see?
But it's still dangerous. It's actually a gamble when you try.
Oh, it is. But that's that's what ARGs kind of do. You essentially know somebody's behind it, and yet because it's presented that way, it's kind of creating this. You're working with people a lot of times to solve some of these alternate reality.
Well,
games.
Look at Cloverfield. Like when they first marketed Cloverfield, right? You just saw that one trailer with them having the party. There's an explosion. They run up to the roof. Then they come down, and all of a sudden the Statue of Liberty head starts coming down. And then it just comes in and says 1-1808, mm-hmm. right? It's no credits, no movie name, no nothing. It's just this thing leaked out on the internet. And everyone's like, what the hell is that? Is that Godzilla? You know, what's happening? That's viral marketing at its core because it's entertainment, right? You know it's a movie. I mean, come on, that's not real. But Blair Witch, any of these other properties, same idea is that if people see it, they're like, what is this, right? Mm-hmm. And they start talking about it. If you look at Blair Witch was a scary film, but it wasn't really revolutionary. But what made it so good was that people could
potentially thought it was real.
Exactly.
Right.
And people talked about it. And the viral element of it. And that's going back to Comic-Con, being this audience, right? This is – anyone who's going to go to Comic-Con, it's not going to be – my folks are not going to go to Comic-Con unless they know I'm there or something like that. But they're not. It's not your average guy on the street is going to go to Comic-Con. People are like, what is Comic-Con?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyone who knows what Comic-Con is,
but if you're 18 to 40,
that's exactly it. And so the idea is that if you can do something at Comic-Con and you can make that audience talk about it, that is the key to that industry. And that's why I think the film industry has moved into it. I mean, all the comic book – when I started going to Comic-Con years ago, all those comic book vendors and all the other guys, they're all pushed to the sides now. It's really sad. And now in the middle, it's Fox and Warner Brothers and all these other guys.
And EA and
– EA and Activision and everybody else has their booths here. And – but something is interesting about it is we're like E3, like we were talking about earlier. E3 has sort of gone away and come back, and it's not really the big, you know, gigantic event it used to be. And it's more tolerable. But Comic-Con has sort of found this interesting combination of culture and
it's become the crossing point.
It really is.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like it's because the one place where every media is welcome.
But and the other thing is it's open to the public, so it's for fans, and yet you do business there.
Absolutely.
Like, I mean,
we're announcing our newest game there this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a fan. It's not just consumer. It's, you know, it's now a trade show in a way.
Well, and it hits both. I mean, for me as a creator, it actually hits both the things that I'm trying to achieve. One is I'm trying to get sort of the acknowledgement from the fans to let them discover it, right? So again, not for me to go out and blast everyone with advertisements and tell them how cool my stuff is. Pick it up, read it. If you like it, it's cool. And if you don't, that's fine. You just walk on by. But the thing that's great about it is that then the industry people can then come by and they can turn their badge around and people don't have to see who they are. And they can say, oh, check this out. We're looking for something like this. And they can see how the fans are responding to it, talk to you about it, get this sort of sense of it. And then they can turn their badge around and say, hey, we want to do this. And that's actually how a lot of our more successful things that we've been working on now have started to come out of that. And for me, this has opened up so many other doors because now people see me as a writer, they see me as a director, they see me as a creator, and I'm not just the video guy, the video game guy that just, you know, scored these games.
Right. Is that where and so what's in the future? Is that where Frost Road came from?
Yeah, so Frost Road, the intent with Frost Road is actually, even though I'm directing these $70-80 million video games, to direct a $70-80 million motion picture.
Not going
to
happen.
They're not going to happen. They're going to be like, who are you? What
are you, Brett Renner? No, yeah. You're not. Yeah. Okay, so bye.
Exactly. So the idea is that even though I direct celebrities on a constant basis, I'm a writer, I do all my storyboards, I have post-production background, I've been doing all these things for years, I need to be able to show people that I can direct more than just doing music videos and that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. So I worked with the same guy that I worked with on Infects. We worked on another story called Frost Road. Brandon Humphreys and I wrote the two sort of story concepts together. And then I wrote Infects this past couple of years, and developed the book. But then I also wrote the screenplay, which I just finished a few months ago for Frost Road. And that's going to be our first motion picture that wrote the script probably over about 6 months, but it'll probably take us another 6 or 8 months to shoot the film.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking to be shooting in November.
Nice.
That's the goal. And with that, now if I can establish myself as a film director, then I'm just a more valuable commodity to everyone, to the agencies, mm-hmm. to other people. Right. He can write, he can direct, he's a creator, he's got post. So I have all those different elements that I can bring to that. And sure. Then on a film like that, I can do the post. I can do
Is there any aspect of the entertainment industry that you don't want to cover?
I'm not really into producing porn.
All
for
right,
a while.
Okay, not, cool. Not right Otherwise, now. But rock star you got, and then you just
do we get you in front
there.
Of the camera at some point?
You know, the funny thing is that because of my experience with touring and mm-hmm. doing the band thing for so many years, I just sort of just burned out on it. And the funny thing is, I can't even go to concerts anymore. I've gone to any like big public kind of things where I used to. You know, we were playing. Yeah, we weren't doing huge venues, maybe like 5,000-6,000 seat venues. If I go out and see a show now, I would rather either be backstage just with my friends in the industry, or just be somewhere where I can watch it, but I don't really care about
it's sort of an occupational hazard, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like actors have a hard time watching something and not seeing the acting, writers have a hard time not
but it's not even
hearing
critical.
The writing. You know?
But that's the interesting thing about it. To me, it's not about the performance or critiquing the performers, because mm-hmm. I still love the work that they do. I actually don't like being in the audience because what happened was that when I was playing, and this, and again, I know I've said it a few times, but it's not, no disrespect to any of these different things, but it's just not for me. So when I would go do these shows, I would have fans come up afterwards and signing autographs and that kind of stuff is fantastic. But then you get people who just want to touch you, who just want to be with you because of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just me, right? I'm not, you know,
you just want to hang out.
As angry as I come across in all my music videos and in the band and all this industrial music, I'd come off stage and I'd be, you know, screaming and I, you know, ripping people apart and stage diving and, I mean, just doing all this really brutal stuff on stage, and come off and just, this is me. And people would be like, what? Who? What? Because they expect you
You're
to
getting
be...
my inner angst out. And, you know,
okay. And they see you, you know, they see me on stage and they see this guy with this industrial personality. I mean, you look at Marilyn Manson, you look at these other guys. I mean, they're brilliant because that's the image they convey on stage.
That's an image.
It is an image. Mm-hmm. And but the problem is the fans want to live that life.
Sure.
And I love that world. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not a poser to say, like, I'm just cheating and borrowing from that, because I've lived in these worlds for 20 years. The difference is just I just don't bring that emotionally into who I am.
Mm-hmm.
So I still love these properties, and I continue to do these for me, not for the fans. And that's actually the one thing, like when we were talking earlier about that deal with Sony and Capitol, I don't write top 40 music, and I didn't do any of that kind of stuff. And I didn't go off in doing that because it was mainstream. And the reason I got into doing industrial stuff was because it was more for me, because I liked it.
Yeah.
Even though I could do the commercial thing. And a lot of people look at these graphic novels and they're like, oh, they're so dark and you're killing people and you're doing these things and it's so horrific. And it's like, I have two awesome romantic comedies that I wrote, and I'm not going to share those for a couple of years. Not until I get established as a director, people can see that, and then I can shatter their expectations and go there. But the problem is that, and people want to categorize people like, oh, he's the video game guy. Oh, he's the graphic novel guy. Oh,
right.
He's this guy. Oh, he's the guy that does those angels and demons. Oh, he's the guy that does those zombies. Oh, he's the guys that do the ARGs. It's like people just want to be able to mm-hmm. categorize someone as that kind of guy. And for me, I have so many interests in so many different areas that I don't like being sort of you know, put like that. So going back to when I was doing these shows and being on stage, when I come off, these people just wanted to be, you know, living in around the people there and just have a piece of that person. Didn't really care who I was as a person. They just wanted to be with that guy.
In that space.
And it was such this sheep mentality that drove me nuts, because there were so many great people that just appreciated the music or were into that, but there were so many other people who just wanted to follow something like a cult or follow something because they were into it because their friends were. And they were just blindly following things. And that was sort of the opposite of what I say in my lyrics and in my books. I mean, it's all about being an individual and actually being who you are and doing that kind of thing. And it was so frustrating. So then when I would go to a concert and I would be in the audience with all these other people just wanting to reach out and touch that musician on stage, I was like,
the ick factor is there.
I don't want to be that person.
I don't want to be there. I don't want to be around those people, and I don't want to be associated or at least come across like I'm one of those people. Because then if I met another musician, they'd be like, oh, hey, great, you're one of those other people, great. And I'm like, no, I want to, I want an interaction with you. I'm going to be the same kind of person.
Exactly.
And I just shied away from that. And I stopped going to concerts and I started doing any other kind of public appearances just because I just didn't like that. Now, going to Comic-Con is a whole nother thing. And it's really weird because everyone's like, you can't be out there signing autographs all the time. You can't be at your booth. You have to have your guys do it. You have your minions do it, right? And you go back and you're like, no. I mean, like, every year at my booth, I'm at the booth signing autographs.
And losing your voice.
And losing my voice.
Yes. So so the people who are listening to this right now, if they're going to Comic-Con, they can come to your booth and they can meet you this year.
They can touch me.
Nice.
Yes.
And that's good. And you do have...
Do you have a sign up that tells them how they can touch you?
So there's before we wrap up, there's an interesting story that you have about how you virally marketed Infects. Do you mind talking about that?
Sure. No, absolutely.
Because it's really kind of cool.
So Infects is a much different story and different world. The basic premise of the world, it sort of helps establish why this worked. But
this is the other graphic novel.
This is the other one that's coming out.
I like the board pattern, too. I mean, it's not a traditional comic book, like, nine-panel thing.
No.
It's really, really nice.
Everything about that, I broke all the rules for doing comic books. I mean, there's no text balloons. There's the artwork sits within these panels as opposed to the whole page being those. And it's got a very graphic design.
Yeah, and there's a lot of bleeding in between panels, which is very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And because it's a transmedia title, this is one-tenth of the story. So as opposed to a graphic novel being sort of a culmination of a lot of different comic books, this is actually sort of one chapter in what's going to be many. The backstory of Infects is there's this researcher, Dr. Leonard Kendall. He is a former Soviet researcher who came out of the bioweapons testing in the Soviet Union. This is all based on real dates and real character, or not characters, but real sort of events that have sort of transpired. And he lost his wife to cancer during his work in the Soviet Union, and ends up defecting. He's arrested for some other unrelated events that happened around some biological warfare experiments that kind of get out and killed a lot of people. He defects to the United States with his six-year-old daughter and works with this company, InGen Bio Corporation, which is the world's leading pharmaceutical corporation. And he wants to use his background in this technology to be able to create the cure to all the world's diseases. He wants to get as far away from bioweapons testing and actually use it for good. And because he lost his wife to cancer, he actually starts to use filoviruses like Ebola and Marburg and other things to infuse them into white blood cells to combat cancer. And scarily enough, about 6 or 8 months after I'd finished the book, the USAMRID released a big news announcement that they're using filoviruses to inject into white blood cells to treat cancer cells. And they're actually doing the technology that was just sort of fictionalized in the book. And I was like, all right, that's kind of scary.
Let's hope it stops there.
Yeah, exactly. but essentially what happens is Kendall discovers the cure for cancer and goes to his partner, Dr. Griffin. And Harlan Griffin is the head of InGen Bio Corporation, who has not only been following technology, but is actually planning on weaponizing it and using it to sell for their military clients. So now, realizing that he's been developing all this technology just to go back to what he started from, he decides he's going to destroy his own technology. He doesn't want to become the next Oppenheimer. He doesn't want to create the next destructive virus that's going to, you know, be used for warfare. And he finds out his daughter is diagnosed with lymphatic leukemia. And his daughter, Evelyn, who mm-hmm. goes by Ivy. And so now, faced with the choice between destroying his technology or saving his daughter's life, he goes rogue and he actually chooses to hide his technology by saving his daughter and embedding it inside of her. And so he actually creates an offsite lab and uses it to do this radical chemotherapy, knowing that it's going to weaponize his daughter. But rather than losing her like he lost his wife, he does that. And in the last few moments of his life, which is the opening 10 pages of this book, which is also the prequel, InGen Bio comes and storms this lab, this hidden lab that he's created. And Kendall is killed in the exchange. And as they try to take the daughter out of this sort of biodome that she's been having her chemotherapy in, she erupts into some kind of monster and just wipes them all out. And so that's sort of the backstory. Infex is the book, picks up 10, 15 years after that time. She's grown up thinking her father just died in some sort of lab explosion and
doesn't remember.
She was in a coma at the time, doesn't know what's happened in her, and the technology's pretty much gone dormant in her. InGen Bio's sort of been watching her for the past 15 years, knowing that that's the only last, or thinking that that's the only last technology of this Intergen program mm-hmm. that they were working with. And she wants to follow in her father's footsteps to create cancer and to create the cure for cancer and be able to stop the world's diseases, goes to work as an applicant for InGen Bio. And during the inoculation procedure, they give her an adjuvant, sort of like what they do to the soldiers in the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. The adjuvant wakes up these dormant cells, and she starts to erupt into this creature again, and they capture her, and then it's her escape through this facility. And so that's sort of where the story takes place. But what's really interesting is that I wanted to find a way to market the book without taking out advertising or without being able to just sort of tell, you know, just go out there and really advertise in traditional ways. So last July, actually about a year ago today, I went onto Twitter and I created an account for Dr. Leonard Kendall, mm-hmm. senior applied researcher for InGen Bio Corporation, and I started blogging as Kendall, and just 140 characters at the time, mm-hmm. and his first tweet is basically that I've begun longitudinal chemotherapy research into recombinant protein Intergen, the cure for cancer. And all these I'd followed a lot of people. I didn't really know much about Twitter. I had kind of linked to a whole bunch of people and told a couple of people privately about it. And all these people were like, "What? What? Why is this researcher like blogging about his cure for cancer?" And they go in and he's got a little picture of himself on the bio, and mm-hmm. it's like this InGen Bio Corporation, and it's got this really cool logo, which is the one that's on the back of the book, mm-hmm. And there you go, and there's a picture of a building, and across the building, right in metal letters, it says InGen Bio Corporation. There's this whole thing about this company in Salt Lake City, and it's, you know, Dr. Harlan Griffin is the president, and there's a website there, and the website is a real website for this pharmaceutical company, and all the backstory of everything that's there is actually all online through the website. So by the end of the first day, and I started doing tweets every few hours, by the end of the first day, we had 5,000 people, unique visitors on the website,
really?
That were just all like, "What is this?" And unfortunately, this is my bad, was that I had registered for a private domain. I changed it to a private domain, but it hadn't propagated through all the sites yet. So a couple of people did some Whois back lookups, and they found PCB Productions,
yeah,
and which is obviously a digital content company. This is my company for doing video games, all this other kind of stuff. So some people are like, "Is this an ARG? I mean, what is it?" I mean, because it looked like it was real. Everything about it looked very, okay. very valid. So I just kept going with it. I just kept going and going and going. And every day just kept putting new tweets. So by 3 weeks later, we had 50,000 people, unique visitors on the site, and everyone starting to go through everything. So, but everyone was saying, "Is this an ARG? You know, what is this thing?" And they started to realize that there was something off about it, but they still liked the fiction of it. And
well, I mean, to be honest, you want them to know
a little.
If it's just a pharmaceutical company.
Right.
Click. If they know that there's something coming out, "Oh, someone said it might be an ARG," or whatever, I mean, might have been kind of good that somebody
But the thing is that the way I structured it was that whole story I just described to you, all from his account, right? Mm-hmm. So him weaponizing this thing and talking about his wife and his daughter being sort of diagnosed and what the results are and how horrific these things are and how this thing is being weaponized. It was just kind of an interesting story itself. So it was just fiction. It wasn't really anything beyond that. Mm-hmm. So just reading it as a story, just from a guy's personal perspective as a blog – it was actually kind of just sort of compelling for so many people going, wow.
And I assume that's still there.
Yeah,
on Twitter. If someone wants to go and find that story, yeah. They can. What is the Twitter account?
It just InGen Bio.
InGen Bio. Okay.
InGenBio. InGen Bio. And so what was interesting was that people started treating it as if it was an ARG. So I love cryptography and all sorts of just hidden clues, and I had been wanting to do something in that sort of world anyway. So I put up a string of after the first week, I started creating other websites, and I created five hidden websites. Mm-hmm. There was InGenBio.com, InGenBio.net, Archive.InGenBio, all these other different sites that you could find.
Sure.
And they were linked, and you could find these different things. And again, there are personnel logs, and there's different records and different photographs of all these experiments that they're doing at InGenBio. And the whole idea is that InGenBio, from the surface level, is this pharmaceutical company, but below ground there's 17 levels of biowarfare testing where
right.
they have these human applicants that have been they're doing all this testing and this biological warfare, and coming from contagion and biohazard and PCBs and everything else, I mean it's familiar territory. So I love all that stuff. And so what I ended up doing was, on one of the sites, on one of the pages of one of the hidden sites, I put this 20 digit string of just text and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I started monitoring some of the forums of people talking about it, because everyone's all chatting about it, like, what is this and what is this going on? And I figured it was going to take them a couple weeks to realize what I had done. Cause, mm-hmm. And what I did was, this string of digits basically was the longitude, the latitude, the universal mean time adjusted for Julian, but adjusted for Greenwich Mean Time. So it was July 23rd. At the San Diego Convention Center,
right,
on preview night at 5:30
GPS coordinates,
and right. they realized that they actually took those numbers, decoded them, and within 2 hours, yeah, they realized the location, the date, what it was, and what it was going to be, and they realized within 2 hours that this was a graphic novel premiering at Comic-Con. Yeah,
you're working against thousands of brains.
It's the
thousands
highest.
Of really,
no way
really
you're
going to
ever
brains.
Outsmart them.
That's yeah. And that's the brilliant part yeah. about ARGs, is that yeah. that hive mentality of so many creative brains all coming together at one time. Because one guy may look at it and say, yeah, that looks like this, but they don't know what it is. And they put it up there, and this other guy says, yeah, but that's this. And the other guy puts this together, and suddenly you get yeah. this collective mentality.
That's what Steve Peters used to say. He said that if you know, you're like, we're going to put up 18th century loot tablature. Nobody's going to know how to do this, and it'll take them 3-4 days to, get a... He's like, hours later, they'd figure it out. So you're just really...
Like, there's
really,
nothing you can do to stump these ARG people. It's just not going
to
happen.
No, makes me want to put, California's budget in an ARG.
I couldn't believe in the last Batman ARG that on one of the sites you had to set your clock to a certain time to get information. I mean, how did you figure that out? How does that work?
You mean on your computer?
On your computer,
yeah. You had to set your clock. I actually found that secret. I did it. It was really cool.
And so that's the thing, is that the only thing you can do is you're never going to outsmart the collective mind, right? Mm-hmm. The only thing you can do is get ahead of it.
Yeah.
And so the idea is to think 30 steps ahead and be able to work backwards from there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so some of the things that we're going
to
do.
And then it's just when you release it.
Yeah. Well, and the idea is, it's just to go back to that Cloverfield idea of that viral marketing of people talking about it, right? Because the mm-hmm. fact that the forums lit up and we had 50,000 people in the first 3 weeks talking about it, that was great. I mean, we sold out of our books instantly, right? At Comic-Con, we had people flying in from all over the country just to grab the book, because once they figured out what it was, and we never acknowledged it. We never went out and said Infects. It never once anywhere said mm-hmm. Infects. It never said the story, never said my name, never said it was a graphic novel, never said any of that. And still everyone knew, because they just found and they talked and they got on the chat rooms. And that's what's so mm-hmm. brilliant about doing ARGs now. And I think that's the one thing that studios haven't figured out, is because ARGs, unfortunately, the only way they're monetized is through marketing, right? You can't
right. –
it's really hard to say, hey, I'm going to charge you $20 to play this game that's going to be hidden that you're not going to know exists. You're
right,
like, oh, yeah, here's my $20. What do I do? We're not going to tell you.
Right.
Yes. Thanks for that. Thanks. Give me that pack.
Right. So one of the things that we're trying to do and what I'm trying to do with Infects in particular is create this world. And the nice thing about Infects as opposed to Dead Speed or Ascend or Frost Road or any of these other ones, I mean, Ascend with Angels and Demons, to do an ARG with that, all right, it's kind of a stretch of the imagination because – you know, you can't see angels.
Gabriel website, or
yeah,
but it's you're always going to know that your theme there. Same with the zombies; it's cool. And one of the things we're going to try to do this year,
dead guy website.
But the nice thing with Infects is that it takes place now. I mean, right. These pharmaceutical companies are now. I mean, all the technology is real. We actually have real press releases. We have actual, you know, physical locations and other things that are real. So the ARG that we're planning for Infects is phenomenal. And unfortunately, I was hoping I can talk a little bit about what we can do, but I can't yet. But what we are doing is going to be the biggest one that's ever been done. Mm-hmm. And that, if we can achieve that, and it's amazing the budget it takes, because it's free, right? I mean, you can't go out and charge people. So to raise the amount of money to do those things is remarkable. And traditionally, yeah. ARGs have been single sponsored base. If you look at Batman, you look at Halo, if you look at these other things, there's a reason why they have the budget to do it, because that studio will get behind and say, okay, we're going to take out of our marketing budget and we're going to do this thing.
Right.
But you're still going to get things and it's promotional, right?
Yeah.
But my goal is to make these living, breathing movies that you live through. And we just did one here in Los Angeles with some friends. It was like 50, 60 people, and it was this private race. It was pretty expensive to do. And it was amazing. I mean, it took us from Santa Monica up to Culver City, out to Forest Lawn, up to – I mean, we were driving all over town, and you had to take all these different things. There was homeless people and actors and other people all over town. Hmm. And to be so immersed – and it was one day. I mean, we came in second. My group came in second. I had some of the guys from the company here, and we missed it by like 20 minutes. The other group had done it. And – it is amazing the heightened reality when you're out in public, mm-hmm. and there's someone next to you and you don't know if that's just a bystander or that's an actor or what that person is. And especially if you treat it as if it's real. I mean, we knew we were obviously playing a game, but if you can theme one mm-hmm. that is truly there. I mean, if you look at David Fincher's The Game, I mean, that's mm-hmm. yeah. anyone who wants yeah. to do an ARG wants to create that. That's, yeah. That is right. the most amazing kind experience. Of. Yeah, except for the killing.
Except for the
death part, but yeah. But that's the idea. And I think that's actually the future of where a lot of this will go. And that will be the glue that will keep a lot of these together for the right property.
Yeah. Awesome.
Excellent.
Well, on that note, let's actually – where you're going to be at Comic-Con.
We'll be at Comic-Con. Yeah, it's the starting preview night on the 23rd, I believe, the 25th. And that's going to be, San Diego Convention Center. We're booth 4039. We were fortunate enough because –
what does that mean? What does 4039 mean? What does
they all have –
decode it.
Yes.
it's the beginning of the ARG, people. Come
40,
on.
4039.
But yes. And actually, we were fortunate enough to be right in the main aisle and the main entrance, which was
fantastic.
Oh,
really?
We've been at Comic-Con. You get seniority just by being there. You know, they just – the longer you're there, you. Mm-hmm. I think there's like a 4-year waiting list for people to actually get booths now at Comic-Con. But we were actually moved to the main aisle, and we're right next to Warner Brothers and Fox and Sci-Fi Channel. We're right in the middle of the hall. It's great for us because
that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean it's just
so
remarkable.
If you want to, I mean, there's two products here that we're staring at that's going to premiere there. If you want to go check that out and
talk to
Keith, and yeah, definitely check out the booth and check out these books. They're pretty amazing, and you know,
yeah, the booth is PCB Productions, and that's also the website. It's PCBProductions.com.
And do you have PCBProductions.com?
Say right? that 10 times, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for talking with us, and we hope we'll be keeping up with all your future stuff too. So we can't wait to see what's...
I will get you guys some. I'll get you guys some little hints as to when the ARG starts coming out.
Nice
exclusive stuff, and we're going to do a couple special promotions for this. I'll get you some stuff for your listeners.
You should lead the ARG through the Geekson website.
seed it with
a couple bits of information. Like, what the
hell? I know that it's been, you know, sometimes it's hard to get the ARGs going, just to get, because you don't want to say, oh, by the way, you've started our game. You know, you need to like be subtle about it. So
right.
You know, that's always
marketing ARGs is, I think, probably the toughest problem because it is hidden.
Yeah.
And one of the films that I'm working on for next year actually just deals with ARGs, which is pretty cool. And that's the thing is that if it's a, I think the best ARGs are the ones you never hear about.
Yep.
Sure, yeah.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank well, you guys. Anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Cool.
Perfect.
We now return back to our regular recorded program, back in our incredibly amazing studio.
Oh, it's incredible.
All right, bye, guys.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Rock it out. We'll be right back.